Welcome to the Demimon Podcast, an unofficial podcast covering the Showtime series Penny Dreadful. Joining us today, we are No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
If you want to join our discussion, you can reach us by visiting our website. You can click on our Twitter contact icon. You can also click on our Facebook icon. And you can also write to us at noshipnetwork@gmail.com. And just in case it's hard to tell what I'm saying, it's noship.net. Also, if you would like to support us, one way is to do your Amazon shopping by clicking on our Amazon affiliate link located on our website. It does not cost you anything extra when you purchase from there. They give us a percentage of what you buy, and this helps us pay for the bandwidth. The best way to support us is to rate us on iTunes. This gets the word out about our podcast, and we get more listeners, and it grows exponentially, and we know you're listening because we see the stats. So
give us a review.
If you have the time, just take a couple minutes. All you have to do is hit stars if you're shy about writing words. Or if you have something to say, then write some words. Tell us how you feel about what you hear. And okay, that's it. So we're going to go ahead and start talking about Penny Dreadful, Episode 5, Closer Than Sisters. This was written by John Logan, directed by Koki Giedroyc. I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly, but that's my attempt. Any thoughts on this episode, Steve, before we get started?
I thought it was a really brave, bold move by the network to do this. Or should I say cable network? I'm not sure what the proper term
Showtime.
Is for that. Showtime. Yeah, it was risky for Showtime to do this, especially after the way last episode ended. Here you had all of these things that they just kind of dropped on us. Is Brona still alive? You know, is she just going to sit there and cough herself to death with consumption? You know, you had a... I don't want to say an affair, but a sexual liaison between two of the main characters, you know, Dorian Gray and Ethan. And you had a few other things that were going on, and then it just kind of stopped. And then you shift over, and you have this whole episode that's focused on basically one character. This is Ive-centric. And it's great because of it. But I think they took a huge risk in doing it, and it paid off. This was a really good episode.
It was a really good episode, I agree. It felt like a movie. It felt separate, mm-hmm. like its own entity outside of the show. Because when we saw the next time on, it felt like they were advertising a different show almost.
Yeah.
And it answered a lot of questions that we had been asked, specifically after the seance.
Yeah, yeah. We were kind of hoping for some of these questions to be answered a little bit sooner than this. But, I mean, we'll take what we can get. And this answered a lot of those questions for sure.
Yes. So let's go ahead and get right into the recap. So the episode opens with Vanessa Ives, and she's writing to Mina, and her narration lets us know that she's writing these letters after she's recovered from an illness, and she hopes that everything will be like it was. And then the next scene takes us back to her youth. Ives and Mina were close friends, like sisters, and we see the dynamic of their relationship during the scene on the beach. Ives is the adventurous, courageous one, and Mina is more cautious and responsible. They lived next door to each other, and Ives has spent a lot of time over at the Murray's household, and she was also close to Mina's brother, Peter, who we're introduced to while they're performing the task of taxidermy. And I looked this up. It's actually on the rise again.
So it's becoming trendy? Taxidermy is becoming trendy?
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a famous Victorian taxidermist that has a book out of the things he created.
Uh-huh.
His name, I think, is Walter Potty, P-O-T-T-Y. It could be Potter. I don't know why I remember Potty.
Check up on that one.
Yeah, but the images are what I remember the most, but he would have like a whole, let's say like 12 little bunnies that he had stuffed.
Yeah.
And he has them all sitting at like school desks and writing in their notebooks. It's really cute, but they're dead bunnies.
So,
you know?
So is this coming back as like a serious pursuit by amateur taxidermists, or is this kind of like one of those things where people in Portland are doing it? You know, Not to necessarily offend any listeners we might have in Portland, but you know what I'm saying. After you drink your free trade or your fair trade coffee, and then you
In
go
your
to your
PBR.
in your PBR, and then you take your beard and your bicycle, and you go down to like your local taxidermy club. I mean, what kind of thing is it? Is it a real revival, or is it just some sort of affectation?
I didn't really delve in it too much, but it looked like some of it had to do with fashion as well as like wearing like headpieces and things like that. But
So it's a Portland thing.
I would venture to say no, actually, because it didn't look like that. But that's could be just one branch of it. I mean, it's I don't really know.
Okay,
I can't
fair
answer
enough.
that question. Okay,
Before we
so.
go on, I want to mention that the houses in this scene are really, really cool. And I don't know which coast of England they're on. I don't know if they're facing into the Atlantic or the Channel. I'm not really sure. Maybe there could have been some hint, in a previous episode about where one or both of them grew up, but I missed it, and they don't really say. So,
Yeah, they have
'cause
that awesome hedge maze as well.
both coasts of England look pretty bleak, so it could have been either one.
I've only been to one coast, and I don't remember which one. It was for a school field trip, and I lived there. And they have these really these worms that you have to try to dig up as quick as you can. That you can see just a little squiggle of sand at the top of the sand, and then you go and you try to dig as fast as you can because the worm is just going downward, trying to get away from you the whole time. And
I think I remember something like that. I don't know if I remember you telling me the story sometime in the past, but I lived in England as well, and we went on a field trip to the shore at some point. I just remember it being really, really rocky. Like it was as much sand as it was rock.
I don't remember the rocks so much. I just remember a lot of wet, tan-colored sand. And it was like really flat
Is
for
it
a.
Brighton?
Might have been. That sounds familiar. Might have been Brighton Beach.
Was funny because I went to Brighton one time, and the only people who were swimming in the pool on the other side of the road because nobody wants to swim.
Okay. So while they're stuffing their animals, Mina and Ives talk of who they will marry. It is said that Ives will marry Peter. And Peter says he will be going to Africa with his father. He doesn't seem too interested in marrying Ives.
Yeah, he's kind of like, yeah, I'm going to be with my dad in Africa exploring things, so you might want to find some other guy with a mustache to marry. There's quite a little bit of talk about finely waxed mustachios in this episode.
See, that was probably, a peak of popularity too in Victorian era.
'Cause these days you just don't really see a guy who just has a mustache. It's a no-no. You can have all the rest of the attendant facial hair, and the mustache can be part of that, and it's okay.
It has to
But
be
if
a combo platter.
a number four supersized to go. Yeah, but it just can't be a la carte then. You can't have the mustache by itself. You just
So, Malcolm Murray, he arrives home from a long trip to Africa, and he is warm toward his children, but he's more distant toward his son than he is Mina and Ives.
Well, actually, in this scene, he greets four people total, and he's warm to two of them, Mina and Vanessa, and he's really cordial and just formal with his son. He's like, son, and he shakes his hand. And then when he sees his wife, he walks over to her, and she has like this, oh, like
Gladys,
tears in her
yeah.
eyes, Gladys. Yeah, she's happy to see him, and he's like, none of that now, dear. And he gives her a peck on the cheek, I don't know.
Were you disappointed to see that behavior from Malcolm Murray?
I was disappointed in a few characters in this episode. Well, I'll only two, really. Just Vanessa Ives and Malcolm Murray, both of them who I've had the utmost respect for as characters up until this point. And I'm not saying that they got knocked down to square one or anything like that. I don't dislike them by any means. They're still probably my favorite. Well, Vanessa's still my favorite character, but Malcolm could have been a second, but not anymore. But it's just, in my estimation, they went down a little bit, I mean, at least give her a big hug and a big wet kiss, you know what I mean? Just, when's the last time you saw her? He's probably in Africa for what, like 6 months, 8 months, something like that.
At least. So later they feast, and it's both the families are feasting together, and Murray talks of his encounter with cannibals. And while he's talking about this, the older Ives is narrating over this whole dinner conversation, and she's talking of things that she didn't pick up on as a child, little hints of problems that were going on between the family, or mostly about Malcolm Murray and her mother, I
Right.
think. Because you kind of see that they're flirting a little bit at the table, or there's more
She
attention.
notices that as a kid.
Yes.
You can tell, well, she doesn't, it doesn't necessarily register to her child mind that they're flirting because she might not know exactly what that is or what it looks like. But you can look at her facial expression when she sees the two of them conversing and you can tell that there's something going on. She's registering something that's a little bit out of the ordinary and perhaps maybe not proper.
And so later that night, she's walking through the maze and she discovers Murray and her mother having sex. And she, we learned from the narration that she enjoyed watching what she saw. And at the same time, something had whispered to her and she listened to it. She thinks that perhaps that this was a demon and that maybe it has always been there waiting for her. And at this point, she's praying, I think, at her bed. She's still the young Ives, and she looks over her shoulder and she looks into the mirror, which is important because the first time she actually lays eyes on a visual manifestation of it, she sees it in that mirror toward the end of the episode.
True. And it's also a callback to the previous episode where Ethan is talking to Rona and he says, I have demons at my back that would kill me to turn around or something like that.
Huh, that's
Or does he
interesting.
say sins?
He says sins.
Okay, never mind. I take that back.
Sins at my back that if I were to turn around, I can't, something, it would kill me to see them or something like
But
that.
it's still within the theme. I guess it wasn't demons, it was sins, but it's still within the kind of theme. It's stuff at people's back that they're afraid to turn around and look at.
In some ways, the demon and sins are kind of interchangeable in this episode, don't you think?
So this she kind of pinpoints this as the time when the door was first opened for this
Yeah,
demon
creaked open a little bit.
to come through. And it's a It could be seen kind of as a metaphor too, as the loss of innocence, because when you see something like that, you're glimpsing into that adult world. And what your frame of reference is, how you take it, how you understand it and process it, have a great deal to do with how you become an adult or how you are as an adult, I should say. And if she wasn't ready for it, it could easily be something that she, equates with sin and, being bad and fornication and stuff like that, rather than love between two people.
And then, but soon after this, she starts a series of wicked acts, and we see her steal a hair comb from Mina. And you were wondering what type of comb that was. That's a comb that women would use to like hold a bun in place. It's
Okay,
like
that's
a,
why it's so long. All right, that
yeah,
makes
like
more
a real
sense.
thick bun.
Now, one thing that I noticed in the next time on from the previous episode, they show Vanessa taking that hair
A
comb,
young
a
Vanessa?
young Vanessa, I believe. And because you just see the back of her, and Malcolm is sitting in a chair, and she basically attacks him like she's just gonna shank him right in the throat with it. And that scene doesn't happen in this episode. So I'm wondering if that was edited out, or if it's, gonna be like on the DVD extras, or if it's gonna be a flashback from a further scene, or if this is something that she gets, PO'd at him, in a later episode in real time, in present time, and she just pulls the thing out again, and she's like, I don't know, but I've noticed that. I don't know if they mess up when they do that, but when they show you a next time on and they don't actually have that footage in the episode that you're watching, I mean, how are you supposed to take that?
I need to watch that again because I don't remember that. I'll watch it again before we record the next episode.
Okay.
I know you mentioned it, but so it was a young and not because it would make more sense if it was like the more older, like after she had sex with Mina's fiance
I want to say
time period.
it was My memory wants to tell me it was
Your little girl.
the little girl, but I only saw it the one time after we watched, the last episode and they showed you what was coming next. And so, I
Okay.
haven't seen it again.
So we see a transition scene, which is young Ives walking through the maze, singing to herself, and then she turns into a young woman Ives, which is now Eva Green. And Mina is also in the maze, and she is currently being courted by a mustachioed man. His name is Branson. And Ives begins to become envious of Mina as they continue to show Mina and her relationship with this Branson man.
Now, before she sees them, she's kind of walking through and she's just running her hands along the shrubs and everything. And she has what I think you could define as a shit-eating grin on her face. It's like she's smiling at this joke that only she knows about.
I remember you saying that when we were watching it.
Just, it looks like she's, there's
She's
something going
thinking
on in
wicked
her.
thoughts.
She's thinking wicked thoughts and they're making her smile.
So yeah, we see Branson and Mina and Peter and And Ives, because Ives is not really even that into Peter. She's like, well, I'm gonna be stuck here with Peter and you're gonna be off in India. She's like, what am I gonna do? So that's where she starts to feel envious, and don't remember if she said hate. Did she say she was feeling like she didn't say that,
I
did
don't
she?
think she did.
Okay.
I don't remember it specifically.
Okay.
But you've seen this episode one more time than I have,
That
so.
doesn't mean anything. So next we have a scene with Peter and Ives walking the maze. Peter is still set on going to Africa with his father. His father is yet unwilling to take him. He talks of being a disappointment to Malcolm Murray, and then Ives kisses him, but he is not responsive, not least you would expect when Eva Green's kissing somebody. And he hurries away. Ives watches him walk away and knows he will die in Africa.
Now, how does she know that?
Maybe that door's opened a little bit more than.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I don't really understand. Like, how far back does this really go? Because she even before, she even questions maybe it's always been there.
Yeah, and then
So.
it took something like her catching her father and or not her father, but her friend's father and her mother having sex in the shrubs for it to kind of kick off and be known as a presence. From what I understand about possession lore, they're gradual things. They don't happen just all at once. It's
It's like an infection.
it's well, yeah, I guess it's an infection of the mind and the soul. It's something that kind of creeps in, and there's usually guilt associated with stuff, and then slowly over time you start to build the symptoms and then it becomes full blown. I mean, if we're treating this as something that's real, that's if. But it's not like Evil Dead possessions where it just happens right away.
So hot on the heels on Peter's rebuff toward her kisses. She's desperate because she doesn't know what's gonna be her future. She's praying quite fervently, and God doesn't answer her, but another does. So after this scene, we see the dinner party where they're celebrating tomorrow's wedding of Mina and Branson, right? And Ives walks the floor greeting the various guests, but she has this sort of energy that's kind of weird and flirtatious in a way, like the way she kind of drags her nails across Mina's back. But she's also kind of weird and fake toward her too, it seems like.
She almost seems like a little bit out of character, like she's not being genuine.
And when it's bedtime, they share a bed. Mina sleeps, but Ives ends up leaving the room, and she encounters Branson down the stairs, and she asks him if he would like to see something interesting. And then she
We all
shows
know where this is going.
and she shows him the stuffed animals, and she shows him specifically her creation, Ariel, after she showed him Mina's.
Now think about the juxtapose the two different creatures at this time. You've got Vanessa Ives' creature, Ariel, who's this huge bird of prey with the feathers just pluming up, you know what I mean? And she has the mirrors behind the eyes and everything. And when she shows him, Mina's, it's a little squirrel. It's the prey. She's the predator and she's the
To the prey.
prey. She's the timid one and she's the bold one.
She's also the one with the mirror behind the eyes. So she talks of putting mirrors behind the glass eyes so they will spark. And she says she would put mirrors behind the entire world if she could, and they kiss each other. And then they fuck on the table.
This is rather rough sex too. He's like putting his hand on the side of her face
Well,
and
she
then
went up
kind of
for more kissing, and he was just like, no. He just like put his hand on her face and pushed her away.
See, I hadn't really thought about this before, but I mean, what is he doing? I mean, I know he's getting some before he gets married, I guess, because he says, when she comes down the steps after she gives Mina a peck on the cheek, he catches her, I'm sorry, she catches him with a drink in his hand, and he's like, "Oh, you caught me. One last night of freedom." And so I don't know if this is supposed to be analogous to like a stag night or something like that, or going out to the strip club before you get married or what have you. But he doesn't really want to be intimate with her in a loving fashion. It's more just like a,
He just wants to fuck her. I mean, I don't know. I don't. It seems to me like maybe he just sees Mina as this is the girl I want to marry, and Ives is the girl I want to fuck. She's the girl that's got the fire in her eyes, the mirror behind her eyes. I don't know. That's my assumption. And when Ives sees Mina watching them, she does not stop the fucking. Not. She just. It's almost like she's absent at that point. Like she's not even in her body.
So do you think that's a valid thing? Do you think that she's actually the demon has kind of taken a little bit of control at this point and said, this is what I'm going to do because I want to experience this, so I'm going to initiate this between the two of them? Because it just doesn't seem, I can understand Ives being jealous, but the episode's called Closer Than Sisters. These two grew up together. They did everything together. And she's going to her best friend in the whole world, somebody who is as close to her as a sister. She's going to ruin that for her on the night before it happens, intentionally and with malice. It's hard for me to believe that. I think she hasn't let herself off the hook for that, as we can tell by everything that's been set up until this point and what's said at the end of the episode. But I think that there's other influence there. I don't think it's just her. That's why she doesn't even register a reaction when she sees Mina.
I agree with that, and maybe because I would like to believe that, and I'm hoping that she'll maybe reflect on this and have some input that will clear some of that up for us,
Yeah.
as we venture into further episodes. But I think she was being influenced, maybe since at least since when she saw Murray and her mother having sex.
Yeah. Oh, you go back
Maybe
to.
she's, the thoughts of desperation and envy that she's having, as the life changes that are happening for everybody around her, for Peter and for Mina, but hers seems to be stagnant, like nothing's changing. Maybe that insecurity, the fire, and it was, kind of fueled by that inner voice that maybe wasn't her own, that caused
Yeah.
her to act out in such a way.
Because I'm thinking back to episode two after the seance when she kind of seems to be somewhat herself, at least a little bit. She's not, talking gibberish or bending over backwards in an inhuman fashion. She storms out of the house, Zidler's house, and she just, finds the first random guy on the street and they have sex. So it leads me to believe, I think everything you're saying is valid and it's probably closer to the mark, but I think that, whenever there's a demon who's in possession of somebody who's good looking and is not strapped to a bed, they probably take advantage of it and, enjoy the pleasures of the flesh. After all, why have a possession in the first place if you're not gonna,
And I think it turns out that Ives is pretty strong-willed, so it's probably not as easy for that demon to take charge all the time. So that's why we see more of Ives than we see the
Yeah,
demon.
especially as she gets older. I think there's some missing pieces here that are going to be filled in with other kind of jaunts to the past to show us how she's been able to conquer this as time has gone on, or at least come to some sort of, like, I don't know, a line drawn in the sand to where, you're going to have to push really hard to get past this. So you just stay on your side and I'll stay on mine.
She makes a deal with the devil, maybe.
Literally. Literally.
So next morning, Branson makes his departure, and Murray watches him go in cold anger. Mina cries deeply on her mother's shoulder, and at the Ives household, Ives' mother confronts her about what happened, and she tries to stop Ives from going over to the Murrays, and she also talks of shame. And then Ives lashes back about what she knows about her mother and Malcolm Murray.
Gasp.
And then Ives walks over to the open gate and she encounters Malcolm Murray himself and she tells him that she must see Mina. He calls her a cruel little girl and closes the gate on her. And then she walks the wooded ground and then soon passes out.
So at least Malcolm Murray is subscribing to the theory that she is just somebody who's just gripped by jealousy and doesn't want other people to, go off to India with their new husband or go off to Africa with their father exploring and her to be left alone in her palatial estate to stare at the bleak English coast.
This is where the infection is full blown now, or whatever affliction she has, which we know it to be a demon, but nobody knows at this point what's going on with her. And she's bedridden. Her mother and care worker struggle with keeping her down in the bed in the midst of these seizures and foaming at the mouth. And later, when she's finally calm, her mother talks to her about how the doctors fear that something is wrong with her brain. Her mother tells her that Mina has left. And that the Murrays and the Ives family no longer speak to each other. Her mother tells her that they will be consulting a specialist in London and that there is a clinic nearby that is well known for treating women's disorders. And this is where Ives says she's not mad and her mother should let her die. At this point, her mother weeps.
She's just feeling super guilty about everything that's happened because she never found any closure. I'm not just super guilty, but she's feeling super guilty about not having any closure with Mina about what she did. She can never make up for it, but at least she could talk to her and say, I'm sorry.
You think that's why she's saying she should be left to die or let.
I'm thinking, well, no, I think it's a combination of things. I think that she realizes or she feels at this point that whatever's happening to her is not reversible. And she's gripped by the guilt that she feels for what she did, the betrayal of her best friend. So she's just a wretch, and it's better just to leave her to die.
So now we're at the sanitarium. Dr. Louis C.K. attempts to question. He looked a lot like Louis C.K.
Little bit thinner version,
Yes, but a lot like him.
The hair and the facial hair,
And the
definitely.
eyes, I think. So he attempts to question a silently fuming Ives in front of her parents, and he asks Ives' mother to leave the room because he has to speak frankly to the father. And Ives' mother had to insist twice that she would like to stay, and that just illustrates the time, how women were thought of as delicate and couldn't handle news like that.
But she definitely wears a pants in that family because the husband didn't put up a fight.
Now he's pretty listless. And so the doctor talks of Ives' condition and the various treatments. He talks of the cryotherapy or hydrotherapy, where the cold water, and then he also talks of surgical options as a last resort. And this is where Vanessa Ives finally speaks up, and she says, "Yes, let's do that."
That one. Let's do that.
This is where the doctor tells her parents to leave the room immediately, and he begins to question Ives because I guess he sees this as an opportunity. And
When she's finally talking, she's being responsive, so.
then she begins to talk of things that is not possible for her to even know about, like talking about death on a slave ship,
And
drowning.
she's talking about how these men on the slave ship are already in this agony and, torture, and then they go into a greater one, and she has this look on her face like she's getting hungry, like she wants to devour the souls and feed off of that despair.
And when she's saying this, you can see he's disturbed by it, but then she says his full name, which probably to him, like that's impossible for her to know. And this scares him, and he hits the oh shit bell, and he tells Vanessa to sit down. And this is where she says, "Who is Vanessa?" And she lunges toward him, trying to bite him. And this is where orderlies finally come in. They restrain her. She's taken out of the room. And then we see a series of scenes that involve her treatment with the cryotherapy, with her being immersed in that ice cold water and
The ice bucket challenge.
the ice bucket challenge. She babbles in strange tongues. And at one point, she is sedated and she's dragged to a shower room where she is chained up and sprayed down with a fire hose. I don't know what they would achieve with that. It's like,
Is that more of the hydrotherapy?
I don't know. I didn't come across any of that in my reading. I don't know, because it's almost like they would spray her and they would stop just to make the person think,
Have you ever been sprayed in the face with a hose? Not like a fire hose like that, but just like a garden hose. Like if someone runs up to you and is spraying it at you, you can't concentrate. You can't think. You feel like you're about to. It almost gives you the sensation like you're drowning. First, not that I know what drowning feels like, but they say it's like that. And I think what they're doing is they're trying to induce that state to where it pushes a person to a crisis or panic mode, and then they break free of whatever's, holding them down, psychologically speaking.
It sounds like a weird, torturous type of meditation or something.
I'm not saying it's legit or that's even what they're doing. That's what it seemed like to me. It made for a really visually gripping scene because she's basically crucified. You know, they have her and they just keep spraying her, and you're just like, why are you doing this to this poor little girl?
Well, she looks like a crucifix. She wasn't crucified,
I know,
but
but I
she.
mean, obviously, yeah, they just tied her up, but or had her strapped. But I mean, it's hard to watch.
So then after that treatment, we see her with a bit in her mouth and she's getting a haircut, and then they shave her this she gets her head shaved completely, and during this whole process she's weeping with cold fury on her face. And then we next see that she the whole point of getting her head shaved was to prepare her for surgery. Because in the next scene, she's on a surgical table and her head is in this sort of surgical grip or vise. And the doctor punctures her skull with this apparatus that looks like a wine cork, wine decorker, I should say. And out of everything I saw in this episode, including the instance that killed her mother, this was the most disturbing for me. Most certainly when he pushes on her skull. Right
because
after you
all
punctured
that bone is broken, and you can see it underneath the skin. They did a really good job of the prosthetics there because you can see it moving under his finger.
gives me chills. That's called trepanation. That's we had wondered if that was lobotomy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Apparently lobotomy didn't come about till 1930. So this is pre-1930. Trepanation was a method used mostly in medieval times, and it was a hole that was bored into the skull that would presumably allow the evil spirit to escape.
See, that's silly. That's silly. And didn't you
And it was done for centuries. I mean, even as far back supposedly as the Neolithic period. It
but they're
going
still
on.
Doing it now, right?
Yes, there's a website for people who really are into, what is it? I think it's like trepan.com.
So people actually go and get this procedure done because they feel like they have a spirit in their head? Yeah, your computer will probably instantly get a virus or something. It just sounds bad. I mean, if you believe you have a spirit in your head, that's a separate issue. You know what I mean? I don't know what to tell you about that. But if you believe that spirit can't exit your head through one of the five holes in it that you already possess, maybe you need that. I don't know. Maybe you just need another. You know when people say I need that like I need a hole in the head? It's got nothing to do all day long but wander around inside your head. It can't find one of these places to leave. Come on. Come on. And people are still doing this crap. This is not FDA approved.
So I'm wondering if, because this apparently Victorian period, they actually were becoming more humane with their asylums. This wasn't a common practice to do trepanation. So there might be some scenes cut out or we're left to just decide on our own that this doctor was at the last resort. He did mention surgical options, so this must have been what he meant.
He mentioned surgical options right from the get-go. He said if the hydrotherapy doesn't work, we're going to go with the surgical option. And then she knows his freaking middle name, and she's talking about people on slave ships drowning and stuff like that. It's a young Victorian woman is not going to know this stuff.
Well, the common surgical option in the Victorian period was to remove their reproductive organs.
A hysterectomy?
Yes. So I don't know if that's what he meant. But so I don't know if this was like a last resort that he maybe after seeing her speak in all these tongues and know things that she couldn't possibly know, if he was just like, okay, I'm going to pull out the archaic book I have and dust it off and I'm going to do this trepanation thing.
It worked to at least to the extent that they felt like she was well, quote unquote, enough for her to be back at her house.
Yeah. Well, because she was pretty much catatonic at that point.
Well, yeah, there you go. That's why I say quote unquote, because I mean, she's obviously not cured of anything, but she's not speaking in tongues and thrashing around and writhing on the bed.
Not yet. Well,
yeah, not yet anyway.
So, yeah, speaking of, Ive's parents are at home in their living room one evening. And some time has passed because Ives is now home and upstairs in bed. And her parents hear the doorbell ring. Peter has come to say goodbye because he is finally off to Africa with his father. Ives' mother warns Peter of Vanessa's condition. And we see soon after Peter goes up the stairs, that Vanessa is in bed looking catatonic and breathing loudly.
And looking like Winona Ryder.
Because of her short haircut.
Yeah, she's sporting the Winona Ryder haircut.
So Peter sits with her and tells her he is going to Africa. And then she wakes up a little bit out of her catatonia.
Yeah, that's a word.
She wakes up a little bit out of her catatonia, and she says that he should have kissed her. And she asks, will he kiss her now? And he does. And then she tells him that he will die in Africa.
This is a direct homage to The Exorcist.
Yeah.
Right here. You're going to die up there, she tells the astronauts. But you know, and like I've always said, if you're going to, you can't do possession stuff. I'll keep this short and sweet, but you can't do possession material on TV without, you know, retreading the ground that The Exorcist has done, unless you get like super original, which I haven't seen yet. And so it's best just to kind of recognize the source material right up front. And I think they did a good job.
With them putting her in the water and everything kind of reminded me of Reagan having all those surgical
The spinal tap
procedures.
and
Yeah, all the stuff
everything.
they were doing to try to find out what was wrong with her.
The encephalogram.
So he leaves her bedside frightened, and then when leaving the house, Vanessa's mother asks, "What did she say to you?" And Peter lies and says he couldn't make it out. In the next scene, Vanessa's mother sits alone in the living room. Vanessa's asleep upstairs, and she is soon awakened by a voice asking if she knows Keats. She sees this person, Malcolm Murray. She sees a reflection of him in her mirror, and then she starts to have a conversation with him. And any thoughts on why he's presenting, or it is presenting itself as Malcolm Murray?
Yeah, actually, I believe it's going to the devil or the demon or whoever is going to appear to you, however you've constructed it in your head. Whatever is going to scare you the most, infuriate you the most, or become a symbolic representation of the thing that changed you the most. And that was her exit out of childhood and into adulthood when he saw her banging her mom. So that's who she picked. That's who was in her head. And plus, this guy, who was kind of like a second father figure to her for so long, basically shut that gate on her forever and said, "You're a cruel little child." And so she's got a lot of baggage. She's got a lot of issues attached to this guy.
Yeah.
So that's why the demon appears as him, because this demon's plucking it right out of her mind. At least we can safely assume, I think. And he's taking on that shape because he knows it's the one that's going to disturb her the most or give him the most traction or leverage with her.
So what do you think it is with this Keats poem that he's using to communicate with her or try to use to convince her to? Is it because it is a poem that's about a person who knows they're dying, and she's kind of in that state at
That's
this
all I
point?
can think of is the fact that without his help, she would be dying. And he says that, this poem is beautiful because Keats knew he was dying when he wrote it. And I'm not familiar with the poem. You are a little bit more than I am, or a lot more than I am, actually.
It was my favorite poem when I was in high school.
Yeah, see, and I've read it before, or at least certain, verses of it, but I've never, I'm not intimately familiar with it by a long stretch, so I can't really speak to, the content of it, but I can say that there's some significance, English much, there's some significance to the fact that she is dying, or at least appears to be dying on that bed and just wasting away to nothing in a, semi-catatonic state. And he's reciting this poem to her, and she knows it because she's reciting lines back to him. He's trying to entice her into a deal to keep that door open.
Well, he talks of power and the sight beyond this world, so he starts to appeal to her in other ways. And he mentions the mirror behind the glass eyes. And this is where he starts to quote Ode to a Nightingale. And this is where she pretty much gives in. And downstairs, Ive's mother, she hears a noise coming from upstairs, and she walks into her bedroom to see Vanessa being fucked by an invisible being, and it's pretty graphic. You hear graphic as far as visually as well as sound wise, because you hear skin slapping and things like that. And she looks frightening because she looks over toward her mom and she has no irises, and her mom dies of fright instantly right there on the spot.
It's a pretty badass scene because it's creepy in and of itself, but it's I don't want to overuse this word in this podcast, but it's really bold. I've seen less scary and less disturbing possession scenes from movies that come out with an R rating. I don't know if anybody bothered to go see that Possession. It was called The Possession. I think it came out like last year in 2013, maybe. Just a, I gave it a C. You know what I mean? It was an afternoon at the movies, nothing more. But this scene tops anything that happens in that film. It's just good. I
It was
was,
on
it
television.
was on television. I was surprised they did it, but I'm so happy that they did it because I feel like this group of writers and Showtime and everything, they're
There's one writer,
one
John
writer,
Logan.
one
Yeah.
writer. Oh, okay.
Just like Vikings.
All props to him then.
Yeah.
He's taking him and Showtime are taking the ball and running with it forward for the horror genre. And I've got nothing but praise for them because the horror genre needs it because there's so many bad movies that come out. and so much, there's just so much crap that's out there horror-wise, and this is just delivering the quality. And it's
And good acting from Eva Green as well. Are you getting
I'm getting a little choked up
are you
because,
verklempt
yeah, well, I'm a longtime horror fan, and for me to see this happening is like making good on the promise of the scare films you saw when you were a kid, you know? It's like, why doesn't anybody make you feel like Freddy Krueger anymore, or, you know, or Jason Voorhees, or Michael Myers, or this or that, or, you know, The Exorcist? Where did all of that go? And this is bringing it, it's not as scary as all of that, but it's bringing elements of that back into a mainstream thing that people can just watch. They don't have to go out to the theater to see it. They don't have to, you know, it's more accessible, and I think it's a score. It's a win.
So next scene we have Vanessa Ives at her mother's funeral, and then much later we are let. It's obvious that time has passed because her hair is much longer. I would say at least 2 years.
I agree. Yeah. It's got to be at least 2 years.
She's walking on the beach and she is met by Mina, and Mina is talking of forgiveness. She's talking of Ives' suffering, and she also mentions her marriage to Mr. Jonathan Harker. Ives says that she's happy for Mina, and then Mina talks of Peter, so he's died at this point. And then Mina starts to talk of things that she should not know, specifically about thoughts that Vanessa Ives had regarding Peter. And then Mina turns demonic and then frightened, and she talks of a master and she asks for Ives' help. She wants to be saved from this master, and then she is pulled away, and Ives is left alone on the beach. So next scene, it's night. We're at Malcolm Murray's house.
Right.
I'm thinking this is the house that he now resides in.
I believe it is because we see it with the rain coming down from the
Right.
same vantage point that Ethan saw it when he almost went back that night.
Okay. So Simbani approaches Murray at his desk, and he tells Murray in another language that he has a visitor. Ives is soaking wet at the front door, and she tells Malcolm Murray that Mina needs their help. Malcolm Murray and Ives talk, and Malcolm Murray talks of how he would have gladly killed her at one point, and he may gladly still. She gets upset and says, how dare he talk to her of death? And he says that they should speak of it together then, and they will follow it to Mina. And once they achieve finding Mina, they will part. So they make a pact of sorts, and he tells Ives that this is her home now, so to go ahead and move into her room upstairs.
Yeah, he says that Sinbinny is gonna prepare a room for her. So there's some good dialogue here because, you know, she says, "Look, I know where your daughter is. I want to make amends. I want to help you find her. How you feel about me, what you do with me after we find her and make sure she's okay is up to you." And he kind of gets on his righteous high horse and he's like, "When I was in Africa, I killed so do you know how many men I killed? You know, every step I took was drenched in blood." And then she gets up on her high horse and she's like, "Do you know what I've gone through, you vainglorious blah blah blah, you know."
Lustful, vainglorious man.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to throw something out here as a speculation. I think that Murray is her dad because I don't believe that that liaison in the shrub maze was the first time that Mrs. Ives and Mr. Murray were intimate together. I believe that that's gone on for some time, and I think that, you know, if you look, she doesn't resemble her dad at all. This guy, I mean, he's barely in this episode. You see him at the dinner table. You see him, you know, kind of half-heartedly tell Peter that he can't go upstairs and see Vanessa. And then you see him at the funeral just walking away, the first person to walk away after they drop her down. You know, so I don't know. She doesn't have his temperament. She doesn't have his looks, you know. And in the episode before that, I don't think he necessarily knows it if it is true.
He says, you're the daughter I deserve.
You're the daughter I deserve. So I think we've now, even if I'm wrong about this, I think we've clearly kind of put their relationship into context. You know, it's like a grown-up daughter. You know what I mean? And she's basically doing whatever he asks because, you know, she's trying to make amends. She's trying to get in good, and well, not getting good with him. She's honestly trying to bring her friend back. And it's touching, you know, but.
Yeah, so speaking of that, the next scene we have her writing more letters to Mina, and she's writing that she will not rest until Mina's safe. And she writes a postscript that that's not revealed to us until she's putting the letter away. And her postscript basically says that, yes, your father loves you, he cares for you very much. I also love you too, but I love you differently because I would actually kill you to save you, I think is what she means by saying that I would kill you. And that this episode then ends with a young Ives and young Peter and Mina running on the beach together.
It's sad. It really, I think that box of letters that's unsent because there's nowhere to send them.
It's like her atonement.
Is one of the saddest things I've seen on TV. It's just, it's a really nice touch to a very macabre episode. You know, it adds that, and, you know, plus she's crying the whole time and everything. It's really good acting. It's really good writing. But that box, you know what I mean? It just contains all of these thoughts, but they're never going to get related to this person because she's just out of the reach of that now.
I don't know.
Or maybe not.
Maybe. There's still hope.
Yeah, there's still hope.
Victor's working on it.
Yeah.
They just need to get another thrall. The other one died.
Yeah, they're running out of Renfields here. They got to get... Maybe they're not running out. It was just a little goofy alliteration, but I mean, I'm sure they can find some more.
So is there any other speculation you want to go into before we go into feedback?
That was the only speculation I had, was that there was just the idea that's been kicking around in my head that Malcolm Murray could be Vanessa Ives' actual birth father.
I only have just some commentary, really.
Is that right to call somebody a birth father or natural father?
I mean, we know what you mean. I'm sure could be correct. But it makes sense about how she's responding to Dorian Gray's attention, because she never had. I mean, she tried with Peter, and he rebuffed her. And
that's a really good point. I didn't think of that, but it is a really good point, because it's like,
because she has so much poise, you know, up until seance time and Dorian Gray time.
Well, it's also like. He's kind of like her kryptonite in a way. You know what I mean? He comes around and she's just like a schoolgirl again. Like, oh, what you gonna take
she's
me out?
Following him around town.
Yeah, I know. Like a lost
her
little puppy
fluttering,
about to eat some nightshade because it smells delicious. But you know, she does mention that earlier in the episode. Mina says, "You're gonna marry Peter," and she goes, "Well, I'm definitely not gonna marry one of those horrible suitors that my father brings around." So there's been other men that have, you know, tried to catch her attention or her hand, or probably just want to marry into the wealth of her family. Honestly, they're probably older than her, and, you know, whatever. She's not interested at all. But, like, you know, Peter's not really a shining example of, like, manhood. You know what I'm saying? And I feel like, honestly, that Sir Malcolm has done Victor a disservice in the previous episode by comparing him to his son.
Aww.
You know? But don't you think? I mean, I don't have anything against Peter. I mean, he's just kind of like, he's this wallpaper character for the show. And I think Victor's so much more than that. You know, Victor's like, he's probably my second favorite character on the show.
Yeah, I mean, I just felt bad for Peter. I think he was at a disadvantage because of just by how his father treated him. So I think that became his focus, which became his reality, always trying to prove himself to his father. And so he didn't really get to maybe become the person he should have become. I don't know.
Like Caliban did.
Right. I don't know. I'm just talking out of my ass here. So
I just felt like if anybody likes Peter or thinks he's a good character, I have no problem with that. I'm not going to try to take anybody to
task. I just feel bad for him. That's all.
Yeah. I'm just saying that I think it was unfair. It was not a good comparison. But then again, he did kind of preface it and says, some parts of you kind of remind me of a son, my son that I had. So he's not saying, you remind me of my son. You're just like him. So I guess, yeah. But we can move on from that. It's not a big deal. But, yeah, I think the whole Dorian Gray thing, giving her attention, is significant, because even this guy, as wishy washy as he was being Peter, you know, she got rebuffed by him. So she's like, fuck, you know, my best friend's got this dashing gentleman who's going to marry her and take her off to India. I can't even get this guy to give me the time of day when I'm basically putting his hands on my tits. You know, I mean, you can't. I guess Victorian speech was a little bit more tame, but I mean, she was basically holding up the big sign saying, here, you know, do this right now. And he didn't want any part of it. So Yeah, I think Dorian Gray coming up to her and being so forward, she was probably instantly taken with that.
And then also just, I think back to what we were saying last episode, I do think now that Malcolm Murray had Senbene follow her because he doesn't fully trust her. I don't think he had Senbene at the theater for her protection. I think it was to see what she was up to.
I see the validity of that to a certain extent, and I think on any given day of the week, I could probably agree with it. But I also, my mind is also working in a different direction because I'm thinking, okay, there's been a lapse of time between the end of this episode when they kind of make their truce and say, let's talk about death together and kind of join forces. There's a lapse of time between there and the beginning scenes of episode one, and we don't know how much time. So I think that there's a possibility that some of that's going to be shown to us, and that we could see a progression of their relationship to where he kind of takes her into his confidence. Because when we first get introduced to them as the two people that this is centering around, they seem to very, very much be working in collusion together.
Yeah, I thought they had a relationship of respect and all these positive
Exactly,
things I
exactly. We'll
said.
see. It could have been built over time. There could be
Yeah.
some lost episodes here that we may not be privy to, and we may not even see in the first season at all, you know? And what those things do is just kind of build their relationship up to the status of whatever. But, you know, if that's the truth, I think that he would have sent Senbene out there to look after her, to make sure that, you know, because she's a valuable asset to him. Because whatever it is that she can do, work that mojo with the demon, it works. I mean, it stopped that master vampire dead in his tracks, you know. So,
All right, well,
but I don't know. I think
it
it's
all
a fi
remains to be
I
seen.
think it's a 50-50 thing. I think there's as much validity to both of our hypotheses.
We shall see, maybe. Okay, so you want to get into feedback?
All right, let's do feedback.
Right, we have again our friend Mike Spa wrote in because he said that this episode was confusing and he had some questions that he wanted to have answered. So I asked him to shoot us his questions, and this is what they are. He said, "Was Van infected when she fucked her bestie's boyfriend? And is the old man infected?" He said, "I think those are the big questions I
My question is, hot tub, are you paying attention?
have."
Seriously. just kidding, man. No, I think we covered it a lot, most of those points in the course of the cast. But I think that, yeah, I honestly think that Van, which is, if anybody didn't catch this, because that was only the term I think Peter used. I don't know if Mina
Yeah,
used.
I think just Peter
Just
called it
Peter
that.
used it. That was his nickname for Vanessa in this episode. I think that she was, if by infected do you mean possessed or under the influence of this demonic, you know, entity? Yes, I think so. I said as much earlier, and I'll reiterate now a little bit. I think that there's a part of her that is mischievous without demonic influence, but I think that it was definitely something that she was under a spell, because I just keep going back to that scene. Whenever I think about this, I keep going back to that scene when they're actually having sex and her head is completely back on the table and Mina shows up. And you know, just as an aside, the look on Mina's face is heartbreaking. You
Yeah.
know, that's just that kills me. But yeah, I do think that there was some sort of influence there. She had to be under the influence to a certain extent. We'll say 85 to 90% at least, because I just don't see how she could have done that otherwise. You know,
And
I
by the
mean,
next morning, it was full blown because by the time she passes out and
yeah,
she's,
there was no turning back after
yeah.
that. And then,
And then is the old man infected?
now by the old man, I'm going to assume you mean Malcolm Murray. And once again, I think it's an issue. I don't think he is under the influence of anything except for his own indomitable will to get his daughter back. When we see him in Vanessa's bedroom, I believe, you know, you notice we didn't talk about this during the main body of the cast, but you notice his eyes turn black for a split second.
Oh, so you know, he Mike Spall must be thinking that's really Malcolm Murray in the bedroom. He must.
I don't think so. That's I
I
think
think that's
that
what he's asking, I
Okay, no,
think.
yeah, you're right. But I don't think that's him. I
No,
think,
it's not.
yeah, I
Like
think Hot Tub's asking that, but I'm saying now that we don't believe that that's him.
No.
That is what Vanessa saw as the demon. And, you know,
The
there's,
demon's presenting itself
right.
in Malcolm Marie's image,
Exactly.
which we had already said, but that I realized now I didn't understand his question until now. So I guess he watched that and actually thought that was Malcolm Murray and not a demon presenting itself as Malcolm Murray. Okay,
Okay,
anyway.
yeah. So, you know, that's how that's how her mind chose to represent the color and the shape that her mind gave that demonic entity
Right.
was Malcolm Murray for all the reasons that we've enumerated previously. And so no, I don't think that Malcolm Murray himself is actually, you
No,
know,
that's not Malcolm Murray.
yeah, that's definitely not Malcolm Murray. So hopefully we answered all the questions that
There were funny
you
questions, by the way.
I like the usage of the term infected. It just makes me it makes me glad that we're not doing the strain. We almost did the strain instead of Penny Dreadful.
Yeah,
Wow.
I know. I'm glad we didn't do
High
that.
five to us for making good decisions in life. Because
Hopefully it keeps up.
yeah.
Okay, so that's it for this podcast. I don't have anything else to say, so.
I'd just like to thank Hot Tub for participating. It's always cool to hear from you, and anytime you want to throw us a line about anything, it's always welcome. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, hot tub. Rub a dub in the hot tub.
Hey. Well, everybody have a good night.
I'm Em.
And I'm Steve.
See you next time. This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.
Look at him kick. Makes you wonder how the other half